across the country. "Ring it," the nurse suggested. Andy picked up the mallet and gave the bell a light tap. Ding. "Come on, hit it," I said. He tried one more time. Ding! Everyone in the waiting room erupted in applause. You could feel the love and energy in the room. All of the patients and their loved ones were going through a similar experience. The mutual support was genuine, and you could tell they were all happy for him. Andy smiled again and bowed.
Thank you,
he joked through his hoarse, soft voice. He was ecstatic to be done with treatment. He was ready to move on. We were ready to move on. Even before treatment ended, he had started working again, beginning at home and then more and more in the office. Before his medical leave, he had been working with local and national advocates in D.C. to push the Washington mayor to issue guidance on transgender inclusion in healthcare, policies that he envisioned would be the most comprehensive in the nation. As a transgender person, he understood just how necessary it was for transgender people to be able to access all the care we may need, including transition-related care. It was the issue at the heart of his advocacy of healthcare access for LGBTQ people. One of the most common forms of discrimination faced by transgender people are blanket bans in health insurance plans that forbid the coverage of any treatment related to a gender transition. Most people think that if a trans person transitions medically, whether through hormone treatment or surgeries, they are utilizing care that is only ever accessed by trans people. That couldn't be further from the truth. Practically every single medical procedure someone might utilize to transition is also offered for other reasons. The hormone treatment transgender people may utilize is also offered to people with hormone imbalances or to women after menopause. The different reconstructive surgeries some transgender people seek are also offered to others for various reasons, including, for example, a person with a damaged vaginal canal after childbirth or a mastectomy for someone with breast cancer. In each instance, insurance covers every one of those treatments and more. But despite the fact that every major medical association deems transition-related care to be medically necessary, insurance plans across the country often ban any coverage of this care for transgender people experiencing gender dysphoria, the diagnosis that refers to the mental anguish caused by having one's gender identity not seen and acknowledged by society. To put it simply, a service is being provided to everyone but trans people. That is a textbook example of discrimination, and it's pervasive. As a lawyer and policy expert at the Center for American Progress, Andy had led the charge nationally to remove the discriminatory bans. It was his legal reasoning that had become the nationwide model, and so far almost 10 states had forbidden insurance exclusions for coverage of transition-related care. Throughout the last few weeks of treatment, even as his voice went in and out and it sometimes hurt to breathe, he had worked with a handful of advocates on D.C.'s new policies. "It would be the gold standard," Andy had told me of the new insurance guidelines. And now, a few months after concluding his cancer treatment, he stood with other activists as the mayor of Washington, D.C. announced the new rules to the press. Standing before cameras in a formal wood-paneled room, Mayor Vince Gray announced, "Today, the district takes a major step towards leveling the playing field for individuals diagnosed with gender dysphoria. These residents should not have to pay exorbitant out-of-pocket expenses for medically necessary treatment." Andy was thrilled. The policies that he had worked on in other states were typically announced with a press release, not a public ceremony. Used to working exclusively behind the scenes, Andy was empowered by the public celebration of the policies he had dedicated his short but eventful professional career to advocating for. He returned to our apartment from the ceremony, fired up like I had never seen him. He was recharged and ready to fight. "I feel like I have a story to share," he told me. "I understand firsthand the need for people to be able to access healthcare that is both life-saving and life-affirming. I want to do more public advocacy." It took a lot for the chronically humble Andy to fully grasp that he had something to say that was worthy of being heard. And it took losing the ability to talk temporarily, and facing the risk of losing the ability to talk permanently, for him to fully comprehend the power of his voice. With the 2014 deadline to enroll in healthcare under the Affordable Care Act approaching, Andy began his public advocacy by writing an op-ed in The Advocate, one of the larger publications within the LGBTQ community, urging LGBTQ young adults to sign up for health insurance. "I was once invincible, or so I thought," he opened. "Like many young people, I was convinced that worries about my health were a world away. That is, until my world came crashing down around me last September." He talked about his diagnosis and the grueling treatment regimen. And though his treatment had ended in January, he wrote that even now my body is still aching and tired. "So it might not seem like I'm very lucky, but I'm certainly fortunate," he explained, always looking on the bright side. "That's because my employer has offered me high-quality health insurance that kept a bad situation from spinning out of control. Had my employer not provided me this coverage, I may have made the same potentially deadly mistake too many young people make. I would have chosen not to get health insurance. Without health insurance, I would not have been able to afford treatment without bankrupting myself and probably my parents," he continued. "Without health insurance, I may not have even gone to the doctor who diagnosed my cancer, and I could be living in ignorance about the fast-spreading disease that was inside of me." Andy went on to bring in the big picture. Despite the stereotype that the LGBTQ community is made up almost entirely of wealthy gay men, Andy explained that most LGBTQ people are not as fortunate as he is. 1 in 3 LGBTQ people making 4 times the poverty level or less had no health insurance. Nearly 2/3 of people in our age bracket, 18 to 34 years old, had delayed healthcare decisions because they could not afford the costs of health insurance or care. The ACA, which Andy admitted was not perfect, provided critical support for LGBTQ people. In addition to the subsidies that help lower-income Americans purchase coverage, the law also provides critical protections from discrimination in healthcare. "Our LGBTQ community is resilient and strong. And particularly for those of us who are young and have our entire lives in front of us, it may feel like we are invincible. I've learned the hard way that I'm not. Cancer has taken a lot from me physically and emotionally," he confided. "But it hasn't taken away my voice. And it hasn't taken away my hope." No, it had not. Even in the face of significant cancer, he remained as hopeful as ever. His attitude personified what Barack Obama called the audacity of hope. And even in the face of losing his speech, even when he literally could no longer talk, Andy's voice was helping to expand access to healthcare and improve lives. "I know, because I was one of the many people who benefited from Andy's advocacy. After coming out to my parents in 2012, I began taking hormones in consultation with an endocrinologist. And in March 2014, just as Andy regained his strength, I underwent surgery myself. For me, just like the steps I had taken earlier in my transition, surgery was a step I knew was necessary to bring me peace. Surgery isn't what makes transgender people the gender we are, but it can affirm us in that identity and further alleviate that pain I had felt so strongly throughout my life. Sometimes vaguely called bottom surgery, but more formally called gender affirmation surgery, I had been anticipating the step for 2 years and had to schedule it a year out. The doctor I chose, a trans woman herself, is one of the world's leading surgeons when it comes to transitioning and one of only a handful within the United States who focus on it. I don't usually talk about this aspect of my life publicly. Too often transgender people are reduced to our body parts, a phenomenon that dehumanizes us and simplifies our identities. I have been asked in the media and by total strangers intimate details about my body. Some of the questions came from people who were misguided and curious, while other people, like the angry woman in Delaware who threatened me, asked from a place of hate. Regardless of my own comfort with the topic, the fact that strangers feel entitled to know about this aspect of my life and body when they would never dream of asking a cisgender person the same questions is just another indignity imposed on transgender people. While I haven't, and won't in the future, talk about my body parts publicly. It wouldn't be fair to talk about my role as a caregiver for Andy without talking about his role as a caregiver for me. And it wouldn't do his work justice if I didn't make clear that because of Andy, I've been able to access transition-related care, care that I needed to live and thrive as myself. Driving up to the hospital in rural Pennsylvania where my surgery was to take place, my parents were a nervous wreck. My dad in particular was on edge like I had never seen him, fiddling his thumbs, tapping his feet, and clearly lost in thought. Now completely used to hospitals, Andy and I, on the other hand, were cool and calm. While any surgery is major, and gender affirmation surgery is not some short outpatient procedure, my 4-hour operation paled in comparison to the 10 hours Andy's took. My planned 3-day stay in the hospital was less than half of Andy's 7-day stay. And after the fear of Andy's diagnosis and concern about losing his ability to talk, the hope I felt going into my surgery was cause for celebration. As I sat in my hospital gown while we waited for my name to be called, the small butterflies were overpowered by an overwhelming sense of relief. I had thought about postponing my surgery given everything that had just happened to Andy, but factors had aligned, his recovery, his return to work, and his strength, to allow me to take the final step in my own transition. I had been hoping for this day for as long as I could remember, and it had arrived. I knew recovery would take a few weeks, but soon enough, I would finally feel whole. "Sarah?" the nurse called, signaling for me to follow her to the elevator. A few hours later, when I woke up from the general anesthesia, I looked at my still nervous parents and exclaimed, "See? All good. No big deal. I feel great." High on morphine, I spent most of the day reassuring my parents how fine I felt. In retrospect, of course I felt fine. I was pretty high. But as the effects of the morphine dissipated, the nurse gave me a Vicodin that didn't sit well with me. Andy was staying the night on a pull-out sofa in my hospital room, and at midnight, a wave of nausea came over me. "I feel really nauseous," I said. "What?" Andy asked as he got up and walked to my bedside. I'm really..." Uh-oh. I projectile vomited all over Andy. "Oh, God," I started to say, mortified at the disgusting scene. "I am so sorry." Wiping my vomit off of his face, Andy smirked and said, "Oh, Bean, what's a little vomit?" I could tell he was almost happy it had happened, that it wasn't him in the hospital bed vomiting on me. "Thank you, Bean," I said. "For what?" he asked. "For creating a world where I can do this," I told him. He smiled and squeezed my hand. Just knowing my surgery was successful helped me feel better. The homesickness that I had been carrying around for so long was gone. And as was the case when I first started transitioning, the absence of a negative was more noticeable than any presence of a positive. I just felt at home. I felt complete. And most importantly, I felt like me. I didn't feel the pain. In the conversation about trans identities and healthcare needs, we are too prone to intellectualize, turning to abstract, theoretical discussion. Too many outside the community seek to find contradictions in our identities in an effort to undermine their validity. I've been asked, "Why would you need to change your body if you say gender is removed from anatomy?" Acknowledging that two concepts are distinct does not preclude them from ever interacting. And no one would expect cisgender people to defend their individual feelings about their own body parts. At the end of the day, it is difficult for anyone to explain a feeling. Pain is such a visceral emotion, so basic, so non-intellectual, that there are few ways to describe it but for the term itself. How do you describe, for instance, the sensation of a burn, but as a burn? Sometimes we feel like we have to make every part of our story incredibly emotional in order to fit a cliche people have about the trans experience. I'm not going to do that. Gender affirmation surgery can be a major milestone for many trans folks, but as important as it was for me, it didn't feel like a dramatic turning point. Perhaps that's because it was nestled in between all of Andy's treatments, but also because my personal relationship with my surgery is a lot like many other people's relationship with any necessary surgery they need to alleviate a chronic issue. It was pain relieving, and I was certainly lucky to be able to access the care I needed. But the proverbial choirs did not sing in its aftermath. Some transgender people say that we never stop transitioning. I suppose that in many ways that's true. But I knew that the most significant steps in my transition were now in the past, along with my surgery. I was living the life I had always dreamed of. I felt seen, and now I felt comfortable and complete. And that's what mattered. In the following weeks, Andy and my parents helped care for me, as I was largely relegated to bed. They brought me meals, they helped me to the bathroom, and most of all, they distracted me with conversation and endless episodes of 30 Rock. I could tell that Andy was relieved that the attention was off of him, if only for a little while. My recovery was relatively quick and easy, 3 to 4 weeks total, and as spring approached, my mind shifted to Andy's upcoming doctor's appointment, where he would get the results of his first follow-up scan since treatment. I wasn't mobile by the time of the appointment in early April, so I couldn't go with him, but I kept my phone by my side, anxiously waiting for his call. Eventually it came, and I nervously picked up. In the few moments before he said anything, I could barely catch my breath. "Hello," he opened, clearly excited. "They said I'm cancer-free." I jumped out of bed, started screaming and dancing. "Ouch, ouch." It's probably a bit too soon after my own surgery for that. "How do you feel, Bean?" I asked. He thought about it for a second. "Free," he responded. "Free. Finally free. Finally, we hoped cancer was in the past. Finally, we hoped we could return to our work and be done with hospitals." That June, we attended our first White House LGBT Pride reception as a couple, 2 years after I had unknowingly run into Andy at the same event. As awe-inspiring as the 2012 reception was, this one was even better. It was more celebratory as the rate of change for LGBTQ people felt like it was accelerating. Trans rights were coming further and further to the forefront. A week earlier, President Obama had announced that he would sign an executive order banning discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity within federal contracts, an anti-discrimination rule that would impact 1 in 5 American workers. The order was the single largest expansion of workplace protections for LGBTQ people in our nation's history. The president had promised to sign such an order for years, but his delay was frustrating advocates. Finally, after mounting pressure from organizations such as CAP and HRC, the administration finally announced that the time had come. But more than anything else, the event felt different because by 2014, I had gotten to know the community that now gathered throughout those two floors of the White House. It wasn't just national leaders. It was advocates and activists from across the country. It was a group of my friends. I was there as myself, on the other end of my transition, with a cancer-free Andy, as well as Sean and Blake, who'd managed to get a last-minute invitation. I was surrounded by family, both blood and chosen. When I came across Valerie Jarrett, the senior advisor who oversaw the office in which I had interned 2 years before, she greeted me with a warm embrace and a simple message. "Welcome home." And with everyone there, that's what it felt like. My heart was about as full as it had ever been. The president was in a playful mood as he addressed the crowd in the East Room, with Michelle by his side. Talking about the White House's outgoing pastry chef, an openly gay man, the president joked, "We call Bill the crust master because of his pies. I don't know what he does, whether he puts crack in them or..." The audience burst into laughter. Michelle interjected, probably knowing the absurd outrage at the joke that would come on Fox News later that night. "No, he doesn't. There's no crack in our pies," she protested. She gave him a jokingly stern look, but he shrugged at her admonishment. "I'm just saying that when we first came to the White House, the first year my cholesterol shot up, and the doctor was like, 'What happened? You had, like, this really low cholesterol.' And I thought, 'It's the pie. It's the pie.' So we had to establish a really firm rule about no pie during the week." The audience was in hysterics at the banter between the president and the first lady. The warmth continued as he recounted the progress we had seen over the previous year, from expanding marriage equality to unprecedented visibility for trans people. Perhaps most importantly, Mitch and Cam got married, Obama said, referring to the same-sex couple on the TV show Modern Family, which caused Michelle and the girls to cry. That was big. Michelle nodded and reiterated the president's point. That was big, she mouthed. But the president also knew the topic was deadly serious. He outlined the continued work ahead, the need for marriage equality in all 50 states, the lack of nationwide workplace protections, the violence faced by the community, and the continued epidemic of AIDS. This year, we mark the 45th anniversary of Stonewall, he proclaimed, referring to the riots against police violence that had launched the modern LGBTQ movement. And this tremendous progress we've made as a society is thanks to those of you who fought the good fight, and to Americans across the country who marched and came out and organized to secure the rights of others. The president closed by articulating a view of America that frames our greatness not as the product of a bygone era, but rather from our ongoing journey toward a deeper understanding of freedom. That's how we continue our nation's march towards justice and equality, he told us. That's how we build a more perfect union. A country where no matter what you look like, where you come from, what your last name is, who you love, you've got a chance to make it if you try. You all have shown what can happen when people of goodwill organize and stand up for what's right. And we've got to make sure that that's not just applied in one place, in one circumstance, in one time. That's part of the journey that makes America the greatest country on earth. The evening was a celebration of love in every way. Love between same-sex couples, love of LGBTQ identities, and for Andy and me, love between two transgender people. Walking through the White House holding Andy's hand, I looked around and realized that this was everything I thought I had given up when I came out. I had found a person I love and was doing what I love. How lucky am I? With everything settled, we now looked to a nearly endless horizon of experiences before us. We talked about our future, about getting married and spending our lives together. We talked about our goals in the coming years and our work. And as the weeks passed, Andy talked more and more about our upcoming trip, my first, to his hometown of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. We would be going for his favorite event, the biannual family reunion known as Volfest, a gathering of about 40 of his relatives on his dad's side named after his maternal grandmother's maiden name, Vol. Since near the beginning of our relationship, Andy had made clear just how much he wanted me to visit his hometown and to go to Volfest with him. He had never brought a girlfriend of one before, and the fact that I was coming was a big deal for him. I could tell it was something he had dreamed of since childhood. Andy was giddy as we landed at the small Chippewa Valley Airport just outside of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. It was late July, and we both welcomed the escape from the humid summer weather of D.C. Andy's mom and stepdad picked us up and drove us back to their house, a two-story home filled with family photos, knickknacks from their travels, and plastic versions of Andy's mom's favorite animals, flamingos. Lots and lots of flamingos. Time for a tour, Andy exclaimed. He showed me his childhood bedroom in the basement where he and his stepbrothers hosted parties in high school. We hopped in the car for a drive through the small town of Chippewa Falls. We drove around the public schools Andy had gone to growing up and the parking lots where he had had band practice. We stopped for ice cream at his favorite ice cream parlor. The main road, Bridge Street, ran down the center of town and included small shops and the courthouse where Andy's dad, Stephen, served as an elected county judge. After a few blocks of small offices and stores, the main drag passed over the Chippewa River just west of a dam that created the large man-made Lake Wasota. The pride for his hometown was evident at each stop. That's the island where my dad does fireworks for the town's 4th of July, he told me, pointing to a small hill in the middle of the lake. Isn't it great? The family reunion took place that Saturday at Andy's late grandfather's house on the lake. I was nervous when I walked the long dirt path toward the split-level 1970s-era home. But the 40 or so family members assembled in the backyard by the grill could not have been nicer. While the cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and extended family came from all over, almost all were Chippewa Falls natives and exuded the term that I had already heard a few times since arriving, Wisconsin nice. Everyone wore t-shirts specially made for the reunion, with Volfest 2014 on the front and a number on the back corresponding to your order of entering the family. Andy's grandmother Vereen, a short older woman who looked and sounded like Betty White, was, of course, number one. My t-shirt didn't yet have a number, but I was assured it would for the next reunion in 2 years. "You just have to come back," I was told with a wink by a cousin. It was the ultimate wholesome family reunion. We played different games crafted over the years by family members. We ate a bunch of pizza, and at the end of the day, with drinks in everyone's hands, we watched the sunset over Lake Wasoda. I was exhausted by the end of the day, but I had loved seeing Andy in his element surrounded by so many loved ones. It was clear he had waited for that day for a while. But throughout the trip, I started to worry that something might be seriously wrong. A couple days before we left for Wisconsin, Andy had developed a cough. I wouldn't have thought anything of it, but it had followed 2 weeks of increasing back pain. Andy didn't think it was a big deal, but I had been on the lookout for signs of lung trouble since his diagnosis. A few months earlier, during Andy's chemotherapy treatment, I had asked Sean about the worst-case scenario for Andy's kind of cancer. What happens if it spreads further? The likeliest place would be the lungs. What's the prognosis for something like that? Well, if it spreads there, it would be terminal. How long? 12 to 18 months. I never told Andy about that conversation. He knew that lung cancer was always a possibility, but he didn't know that it would come with a terminal diagnosis, and I didn't want to burden him with that information. Throughout the trip to Wisconsin, the cough continued, increasing with each day. By the time we were driving back to his mom's house from the reunion, it was incessant. But so was his smile. Driving along the edge of Lake Wasoda, I could easily see myself spending the rest of my life with Andy. But I also couldn't shake the feeling that our world was about to be turned upside down once again. Chapter 10. Amazing Grace. If it turns out to be terminal, would you marry me? I don't think it's possible for a sentence to contain more tragedy and more love in it. 11 words that encompass the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. Sitting on our big overstuffed couch just below a framed cartoon that almost cruelly read, "Game Over," Andy asked me to be his wife. 2 days earlier, just after our trip to Wisconsin, Andy had gone to his primary care doctor to get his cough checked out. X-rays had come back showing something in or around his lungs. What does that mean? I asked the doctor, not wanting to say the word cancer. I'm going to have you go to the hospital up the street for more detailed scans, but he may have pneumonia and it's just some fluid around the lungs, he reassured us. Thank God. I had convinced myself that the news would be more serious, and sitting in our doctor's office with Andy, I desperately wanted his guess to be right. We immediately hopped in an Uber and rode up to Sibley, a small hospital in a sleepy neighborhood in northwest Washington. It was just a few blocks from American University, and I knew Sibley only as the place that my peers were taken to when they had too much to drink at a college party. I never imagined that it would be the scene of some of the most pivotal moments in my life. At least we DVR'd Big Brother tonight, I jokingly told Andy, wanting to act, no, wanting to pretend, like everything was normal. But even with the doctor's guess and our hope that everything was all right, my gut knew different. After Andy finished his scans, we awaited the results in an alcove in the ER. An hour went by, then two. Patients came in and out of the neighboring spaces. Every so often, I'd walk out into the center of the ER to ask a passing doctor or nurse how much longer things would take. "Just a moment," said one, an hour into the stay. "I believe the results should be coming soon," said another at the two-hour mark. As day passed into night, a nurse finally came by to get Andy some water and check on us. "How are you doing?" she asked. "I'm okay," he answered, his voice a bit shaky. "But I'm a cancer survivor, so I'm just a little nervous." "Oh, I'm sure everything will be fine. I believe the doctors should be in here shortly, she responded warmly while pulling Andy's chart up on the computer. As she clicked on different pages, scrolling through, she talked with us about the weather. Then she got to one page, and I saw her body language change. She stood upright, and the small talk ceased. She abruptly but calmly excused herself. "Let me go check on the doctor," she said with a smile that masked something darker. Andy didn't notice the change in tone, but I did. I got up from my chair and walked over to the still-open computer screen. I pretended to look around the windowsill, not wanting Andy to ask what I was reading. But there it was. In the middle of a long paragraph filled with otherwise indecipherable medical terms was the news I feared. "Masses have been found in both lungs," it read. I tried to hide any surprise on my face as I turned around and looked at Andy, who was reading on his phone. I took him in for the split second before he looked up. He smiled at me, and I managed to smile back. "Oh my God, he's going to die," I thought to myself, recalling the hypothetical scenario Sean had laid out to me months before. Just then, a doctor pushed aside the curtain with two younger doctors by his side and calmly delivered the bad news. It looked like Andy's cancer was back and that it had spread to his lungs, something that tests would confirm in the coming days. He didn't say anything about the prognosis, and Andy didn't ask. The conversation was focused purely on the next steps. They'd admit Andy to the hospital for the night for monitoring and to drain some of the fluid that had begun filling the cavity around his lungs, fluid that was a result of the tumors. As Andy talked with his nurses about the logistics of being admitted, I stepped out to call his mother, Artis. "Andy's cancer is, it's back. It's spread to his lungs. He's being admitted to Sibley," I told her, trying not to scare them beyond what I imagined they would inherently feel. "Do you think we should come out?" she asked. She was sensitive to Andy's wishes on the matter, and I think instinctively understood that the family flying out might spook him. "I think it would be a good idea for you to come out," I said. I didn't know how much time Andy was going to have, but I wanted to make sure his family got as much time with him as possible. I also knew we were going to need help. Time started to slow as the gravity of the situation began creeping up on me. It was like I was gradually getting the wind knocked out of me. With every passing second, the reality that Andy was going to die began to truly hit me. But it was still premature for me to tell her or Andy just how serious the situation was, that his cancer was almost definitely terminal. It was too soon, and it wasn't my place. I wasn't a medical professional, and I worried, particularly for Andy, that he would resent the person who delivered the news. I didn't want him to hate me, and the information wouldn't change the steps his doctors were giving him. Still, I felt guilty. I wasn't sure I was doing the right thing. In moments like these, I've learned it's always hard to know for certain what's right and what's wrong. "I love you," I told his mom as she hung up to tell her husband and call others in the family. I had never said "I love you" to his parents before, but I felt it, and I knew they were going to need all the love they could get in the coming days and weeks. Nothing is more difficult than losing a child. Then I stepped into a dark, single-stall restroom just off the center of the ER to call my own parents. As I waited for my mother to pick up the phone, I looked at myself in the mirror. Seeing my reflection made everything feel so much more real. This is real life. This is happening. When I heard my mother's voice, I burst into tears. "Mom! His cancer is back. He's going to die," I cried into the phone. I started hyperventilating. I could barely stand. Leaning against the sink in the dark restroom, I cried like I had never cried before. The type of crying that could burst a blood vessel. I was inconsolable. But I needed to let it all out on the call because I had to return to Andy's side and be calm and present. I explained to both of my parents what we just learned and what I already knew. He had probably a year left. "He doesn't know, and I can't tell him. I need you. Please come down. I need you." My mom was, understandably, also hysterical at the shocking news, and my dad was concerned with her driving down to D.C. in her distraught state. Can she come tomorrow? He asked, going into calm, logical attorney mode that had helped us work through intense conversations before. I wasn't able to match his calm. I was a mess. I fell to the floor of the still dark restroom. No, I need my mom. I need my mom, please. Hearing the fear in my voice, my dad relented, and my mom bought a train ticket down for that night. With my mom on her way, I stepped out of the bathroom, cleared my eyes, and sat for a few moments to catch my breath. I walked back into Andy's room where the nurse was helping him into a wheelchair for the trip up a few floors to his hospital room. He grabbed my hand and I walked beside him as he was wheeled up. I just can't believe I have to go through all this again. I'm exhausted and I thought I was done, he said. But if I beat it once, I'll do it again. My heart broke, but I just let him talk. I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to lie to him, but I also didn't want to add to his burden. He would find out in due course. I decided that my job was to provide positivity and reinforce his hope. My role was to love, not to be the realist. And after all, there are always those people who get a terminal diagnosis and end up defying the odds. Andy could be one of those survivors, right? It was just 2 days later, as Andy prepared to go with his mom to an appointment with his doctors at Johns Hopkins, that he asked me to marry him. I had a feeling the question might come as he began to grapple with the possibility that the reoccurrence of the cancer was far more serious than his first go-around had been. And as the initial shock of the news wore off and he began to think about what came next, it was clear the thought of death was again on his mind. But it wasn't until his proposal that he acknowledged the realization to me. I worried about every word I said to him, particularly in those first days after the diagnosis. I worried that if I said yes instantly to his proposal, he would interpret that as a sign that I had already given up. But obviously I wasn't going to say no either. Let's see what your doctors say before we start talking about that. We didn't have to wait long. A few hours after Andy and his mother left for the doctor's appointment, I picked up my phone to a text from him. They said it's terminal. I didn't think, I just called immediately. It wasn't a surprise, but that didn't diminish the shock. Even though I'd had 3 days to prepare for this moment, I didn't know what to say. I told him that I was sorry. I told him that I wasn't going anywhere, that I'd be right there with him every step of the way. And to the question you asked before you left, I said, the answer is obviously, certainly, without question, yes. I waited anxiously with my mom for Andy and his mom to get back to our apartment. When he walked into our living room, he appeared completely deflated. He fell into the couch and just sat there, his eyes a blank stare. I sat down beside him and held his hand. What did the doctor say about next steps? I asked hesitantly. That I have probably 10 months to a year with treatment. That I, will start chemo, but that it'll be to prolong my life, not save. He trailed off. It was practically exactly what Sean had said all those months before. Staring at the ground, Andy's eyes were filled with tears. The kind that just rest on your eyes, ready at any moment to burst onto your cheeks. How do you console someone who knows that they're going to die? I couldn't tell him that it would get better. I couldn't tell him that he'd beat it. But I also wanted to be careful not to remove his last bit of optimism that would inevitably give him the strength to put one foot in front of the other, pursue the treatment, and grapple with the stages of acceptance and grief. I realized that I just needed to listen to him and love him. Over the next few days, the shock subsided into crying. Lots and lots of crying. He was scared out of his mind, perpetually locked into a look of terror, the literal fear of death buried underneath his beautiful blue eyes. I'm so scared to not exist anymore, he'd scream through the tears, his voice still muffled and impeded from the surgery almost a year before. His cries and deep breaths merged into depressing gasps. I'm so scared, Bean. I'm so scared. And it wasn't just the fear of death. He also spent those days crying about what he wouldn't be able to do for other people. The friends he'd leave behind. The work that would remain unfinished. and the pain that he wouldn't be able to help alleviate for others, including me. "I'm sorry I won't be able to be there for you, Bean," he told me, scrunched up on our couch in the t-shirt and shorts he'd been wearing the last few days. "I'm so sad that I won't be around to tell you that I love you, to tell you how beautiful you are, and to tell you how proud of you I am." I tried to stay strong in front of Andy, but I couldn't hold it in. I couldn't bury the emotions anymore. I felt so bad for him. And here he was, facing death, apologizing that he wouldn't be able to be there for me. Every passing day felt both precious and torturous. We were forced to appreciate every hour, no matter how excruciating or cruel they felt. On August 9th, 10 days after the initial diagnosis, we celebrated my 24th birthday. We ordered pizza, another one of Andy's favorites. My parents and Andy's mom and stepdad were in town, as were Andy's stepbrother, his wife, and their 3-year-old daughter, Addison. Addie, a giggly, cherub-faced little girl, was the apple of her Uncle Andy's eye. He adored her, and as she played with her toys on the floor of our apartment, he tried to muster up his clearly decreasing emotional and physical strength to join her. I hadn't been away from Andy for longer than a few minutes since he had learned that the cancer was terminal. We had both effectively given up going to work, a situation more than tolerated by our flexible and generous co-workers. So with Andy surrounded by family during my birthday party, I asked my parents to join me on the roof of my building for a few minutes. "Is everything okay?" Andy asked after I told him my parents and I were going to go up for a bit. "Yes, yes, of course. I just want to get some fresh air," I assured him. I could see in his eyes that he knew we were going to go upstairs to talk about him. It was obvious. What else would we be talking about? I had to let loose, though. I needed to vent to someone. Over the last week, Andy and I had effectively been confined to our one-bedroom apartment, the two of us largely alone with the creeping darkness of death hanging over us at all times. Sitting on the roof of my building with Washington, D.C. spread out in front of my parents and me, I hesitated to speak at first. I was worried what I was about to say would be selfish. But I needed to process my emotions with someone, and I knew my parents wouldn't judge me for feeling sorry for myself. "I really do always look on the bright side," I told them, almost pleading for absolution for what I was about to say. "I try to always understand that someone has it far worse. I try to find the silver linings in all of the challenges I face. I try to remind myself that negative experiences build strength and character. But aren't I already a good enough person? Didn't being trans do that? Wasn't Andy's cancer enough? What other life lessons do I need? Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to him? Why is this happening to us?" I was trying to rationalize the irrational. I shook my head and looked down, suddenly ashamed. "Every day I wake up and it feels like a nightmare," I confessed. "And I want this nightmare to end. But I also know what that means. The end is Andy dying, and I hate myself for feeling that." "I find myself feeling the same way," my mom confided, sharing the burden of those feelings with me. "It's okay," my dad said. "It's okay, this isn't easy. Sarah, you've had more life in the last few years than many people have in decades, and you and Andy have gone through more than most couples in a lifetime." I needed permission to be human. I needed to be told that it was okay to be selfish, to feel sorry for myself. No one had to tell me Andy's plight was far worse than mine. That much was self-evident. But I did need to know that I could acknowledge and wrestle with my own emotions through it all. I just needed to hear, "It's okay to feel like this." Soon after we returned from the roof, Addison and her parents got ready to leave for the airport. They packed up her ladybug backpack and walked her over to her Uncle Andy and me to say goodbye. "Can you say goodbye to Sarah, Addie?" her mom prompted. "Bye, Sarah," she repeated in the hushed tone of a 3-year-old still learning to speak. "Can you say goodbye to Uncle Andy, Addie?" her mom added. "Bye, Andy," Addie whispered as they hugged. As Addie disappeared out the door, Andy looked at me with tears filling his eyes. "What if that's the last time I see Addison?" he asked, overcome with the visual of the world that would continue on without him, these cruel realizations occasionally hitting him. She's too young. She's going to grow up. She won't remember me. She won't have any memories of me. The simple moments of life that had felt like such triumphs in his initial recovery, and that we held so dear in the months following, now took on a morbid darkness as he struggled with the knowledge that every experience could be the last of its kind for him, that the world he knew would go on without him, that normalcy would return for everyone but him. Between the tears, we talked about the coming months. We talked about traveling with friends. He told me that he wanted to continue doing the work that he had been doing for so long, trying to expand healthcare access for LGBTQ people. He began researching cutting-edge technologies and clinical trials that might offer some small, last bit of hope for living. And we talked about our wedding. With the 10 to 12-month timeline the doctors had given Andy, we tentatively planned for a fall ceremony. Both of us had always wanted a wedding as the seasons changed, and a young coworker of ours volunteered her parents' farm in Charlottesville, Virginia for free. Daydreaming about it was our escape. A sunset wedding with the Blue Ridge Mountains as the backdrop, a crisp autumn evening reception under a big white tent right next to our friend's farmhouse. We both knew it would be emotionally difficult, but the idea of ensuring a big life event, a bucket list item for both of us together, was a helpful distraction. But then, on August 14th, 2 weeks after the initial diagnosis and exactly 2 years to the day after Andy sent me that first Facebook message introducing himself, a doctor delivered news that threw ice-cold water on our plans. "You might not make it to treatment," he said, referring to the chemotherapy that the doctors hoped would extend Andy's life for as long as possible. Those were the first words I heard as I walked into Andy's hospital room. He had been admitted back into Sibley 3 days earlier after his cough returned with a vengeance, and his strength and energy had left him almost entirely bedridden. Since being admitted, his need for oxygen, initially a low dose through small nasal tubes, had increased dramatically. "So you think I might only have 2 weeks?" Andy asked, his face completely white. "Yes," the doctor answered. He paused. I wasn't quite sure where he was going next. There was silence. He seemed to be deep in concentration. I figured he was contemplating the next thing to say since this couldn't be a more serious conversation. Then he said, "Hold on. There's a fly. Let me kill it." He slowly lifted his hands up in the air. Andy and I watched, our mouths still ajar. The silence continued, broken only by a loud clap. The body of the fly fell to the floor. "Hold on, let me pick it up." And he slowly bent over, lifted the fly's body and threw it in the trash. I wanted to scream at him, but I was too stunned by both the news and his appalling apathy towards Andy's emotions. After several seconds, which felt like an hour, Andy broke the silence. "Nice job." Finally, the doctor returned to the conversation at hand. One of Andy's lungs was failing at a rapid rate. "You need to decide whether you want to go on a respirator. Just know, given your condition, that if you go on a respirator, you'll likely never be able to be taken off of it. And to put you on a respirator, you'll have to be sedated. And given your condition, you would likely never wake up." Oh my God. For a few seconds, it seemed like I might have to say goodbye to Andy right then and there. Forever. It sounded like the best-case scenario was that Andy would continue to physically live, but that the rest of whatever life he had left would be spent in a permanent, medically-induced coma. Moments later, another doctor came in and apologized. She had overhydrated Andy after thinking his heart was racing from dehydration. The fly doctor seemed surprised and slightly relieved. The cardiologist prescribed some medications and reduced Andy's fluid intake. Soon enough, Andy's lung rebounded. By that afternoon, he was better than he had been since being admitted to Sibley 3 days prior. The doctors left the room seemingly impressed with their solution. But we were scared, and more than anything else, confused. He was better than he had been 3 days before, but still incredibly weak and requiring constant oxygen. Did Andy have 2 weeks left, or was all of this a temporary problem that was easily fixed? 2 weeks, Bean? I'm not ready for this a walk to remember shit, Andy remarked. He sounded more frustrated and exasperated than frightened. We barraged every nurse and subsequent doctor who entered our room with questions, but no one could provide us with a clear answer. I don't have a good answer, one young doctor told us, but I will say that you don't look like someone with 2 weeks left. It wasn't a ringing endorsement, but it was something to hang our hope on. Within a day or two, the consensus was that Andy had largely stabilized and that the hospital had done everything they could to remedy the situation, and the decision was made to discharge him the next day. Finally, Andy said, his spirits lifted. He'd be discharged with a perpetual oxygen tank, and he was still exceptionally weak, but he was coming home. He hated being in the hospital. That night, Andy's mom pulled me aside in the hospital waiting room. Sarah, dear, have you thought about moving the wedding up? I could tell it was more of a recommendation than a question. I had thought about asking Andy the same thing, but I knew how he would interpret the suggestion. He'd see it as a sign that he didn't have much time left. The fact that his mother brought it up reinforced that it was probably the right thing to do. And while he had somewhat stabilized, things were still moving much faster than any of the doctors had predicted 2.5 weeks earlier, when Andy first asked me to marry him. He might not have had the less than 2 weeks that the fly doctor had coldly suggested, but he certainly didn't seem like he had anywhere close to a year. The morning of Andy's discharge, I sat down on his hospital bed to broach the subject. Bean, what do you think about maybe moving up the wedding? Are you giving up? He immediately asked. No. I just think it's clear that your chemotherapy will likely take more out of you than we thought, so maybe it's best to do it before you start treatment. He smiled in relief. I wasn't being entirely forthcoming, but what good would the truth do? I think that's a good idea, he said, putting his hand on my face and leaning in for a kiss. Once we were finally situated back at our apartment, we invited our friend and colleague, Bishop Gene Robinson, over. In his mid-60s, the bishop was a comforting figure, with gray hair and small circular spectacles. Bishop Gene, as we all called him at the Center for American Progress, had been thrust into the spotlight when he became the first openly LGBTQ person to become a bishop in any major Christian denomination. His election in 2003 to serve as head of the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire set off a frenzy, causing a worldwide schism within the Anglican Church. When he was installed as bishop, the threats on his life were so significant and credible that he had to wear a bulletproof vest under his religious robes. Now retired from his day-to-day work in the church, Bishop Gene served as a senior fellow at CAP, working closely with the LGBTQ team, including Andy and me. Since we first started to plan the wedding, Bishop Gene had been our dream officiate. He had become a good friend to us, and the fact that he was part of the LGBTQ community put us at ease. We recognized that as two transgender people, our love seemed unorthodox to some, and we knew he would preside judgment-free. Bishop Gene didn't realize just how poorly Andy was doing when he arrived at our apartment. As he walked into our living room, he looked around and took in his surroundings. He studied the knickknacks and the small toy robots that I had found so adorable when I first visited Andy at the beginning of our relationship. 2 years later, those items were now joined by my decorations, framed pictures of the two of us from throughout our relationship, and lots of medical equipment. Andy was sitting on the couch with his back to the wandering Bishop Gene, looking out our large apartment windows. The sight of a thin, clear tube stretching from Andy's nose across the floor to a large black oxygen generator made the bishop do a double take. Andy and I have decided to get married, and we would love for you to preside, I jumped in, trying to distract from Bishop Gene's surprise at Andy's diminished physical condition. Clearly overcome with emotion at the requests and the sight of Andy, Bishop Gene cleared his throat. I would be honored, he replied. Just looking at Andy, he understood the urgency of the request, and that any wedding would have to be soon. We're thinking about this coming Sunday on the rooftop of our building, I told him. Not only would I be honored to officiate, but I would love to help organize everything, he said. I have a small budget for these types of things, and I'd like to help pay for it if you're comfortable. We hadn't really considered buying anything for the wedding. Given that we were now talking about a ceremony in 5 days' time, we figured it would be very simple. No flowers, no food, no decorations. But Bishop Jean, and as it turned out, our friends, had other plans. His generous offer stunned us. I looked at Andy and saw tears streaming down his face once again. For once, they were happy tears.
"That is so thoughtful of you," Andy responded, wiping his tears.
"Thank you. Thank you." My brother Sean, who had watched too many people, including young people, pass away from cancer, had told me that I should take stock in the beautiful acts of kindness that I'd begin to see. Amazing grace, Sean called it. You will bear witness to acts of amazing grace. Bishop Jean's offer was just one example of the grace that was filling our lives in what increasingly appeared to be Andy's waning days. With nothing more than a color preference, Bishop Jean and an army of family and friends began organizing our wedding. But as the wedding preparations continued, so too did the decline in Andy's health. He was sleeping more and more. He was relegated almost exclusively to a recliner that his stepdad had purchased for him while he was in the hospital. Going to the bathroom required the help of three friends. "One, two, three," we'd count as we'd lift Andy from the recliner to the wheelchair, in which he'd then be rolled to our bathroom just 20 feet away. He stopped being able to swallow his dozens of pills, so I'd crush them up and put them in his ice cream, about the only thing he could eat. But it soon became nearly impossible to eat even that, taking 4 hours to eat 6 spoonfuls. Almost immediately, it would be time for the next meal medicine mix. A home nurse stopped by for 15 minutes every few days to check his vitals and his strength, but that was it. Andy's friends, parents, and I were left to handle his care, and I became the taskmaster, a role Andy grew increasingly frustrated with as our conversations began consisting almost entirely of me nagging him to eat food. He was scheduled to start treatment the Tuesday after our wedding, and he knew that he had to have some degree of strength to undergo chemo. Otherwise, the doctors informed us, the treatment would do more harm than good. It would kill him. "If you aren't healthy enough to be home, you won't be strong enough to undergo chemo," Andy's oncologist told us over the phone one day. Andy was determined to make it to treatment, but if he didn't eat, none of that would happen. Sitting with a bowl of soft food in front of him, hours would go by with Andy taking only a few bites. "Andy, I need you to eat," I'd remind him. He'd take another scoop, and then sit staring at his food for another 20 minutes. "If you don't eat, I'm going to have to take you to the hospital," I'd plead with him. "Please don't do that," he'd cry. "I don't know what else to do, Bean. You need to eat. You need to take your medicine." We'd repeat this routine over and over again, each meal taking so long that it would bleed into the next. A mostly full bowl was perpetually in front of him. When Andy wasn't attempting to put his all into eating ice cream, he'd excessively check his vitals with a fingertip clip that he asked us to buy for him. The small device that attached to his pointer finger measured his pulse and oxygenation level. For people with cancer in their lungs, the oxygenation level is a key measurement. It indicates the amount of oxygen making it into your bloodstream. Measured on a scale of 1 to 100, healthy levels are in the high 90s. Fatal levels are in the 60s or 70s. But anything under 95 was problematic. We were told a person would likely lose consciousness somewhere in the 80s. Each day, he watched as his oxygenation levels fluctuated between 95 and the low 90s. Sometimes, it'd drop into the 80s, and we'd have to turn up the amount of oxygen coming from the generator. Each increase would give him a little more energy, but as we approached the maximum output for the home machine, each increase also brought him closer to needing to go back to the hospital. Our only respite from the now constant struggle to keep him oxygenated, hydrated, and nourished was the wedding. Even with our friends handling most of the logistics, there were still small decisions for us to make. One was the song that would play after we exchanged our vows. "Give me a thumbs up when we get to one you want," I told him, knowing that talking was becoming too tiresome. One by one, I played different songs as Andy drifted in and out of sleep. No thumbs up. But then I got to the song he had played for me in the car on our first date.
the one I had listened to every day on my way to work at the White House, the one that had played when Sean and I spoke at the Human Rights Campaign's national dinner just before Andy's surgery. When Safe and Sound started playing, Andy's eyes opened a little. He looked at me, managed a small smirk, and lifted up his thumb.